Somewhere, there's a picture of a firecracker going off at the exact moment it hit the stage. A fan mailed the photo in. The flash was going off right between Joe and me at the exact second the M80 blew up. It was as we were just coming back on its stage for the encore. I got a singed cornea from that one, and Joe cut his hand. The wound on Joe's hand was the shape of a smile, so Joe drew a face on his hand, and he would wiggle it and make it talk. There was the smashed glass bottle at the Spectrum in 1978, which stopped the show. Fans get excited, they get demented. They don't believe we're entirely human and do this stuff to find out if we bleed the same way they would. One time, we found a shuriken, a fucking ninja throwing star, on the stage. These are war stories. When you're on tour, short of loss of life and limb or actual death, you have no time to get sick like a normal person. There are no days off. You're working yourself to death. The only thing that got us through was the cocaine. For the whole of the 70s, we were all nicely fucked up and deep fried. There's a photo of me somewhere snorting a huge rail of blow off a picture of myself in a Japanese magazine. What a great way to get high. I snorted my own face. Blow was our rocket fuel. In the end, it takes you down, but it's probably one of the reasons we got as far as we did. We never stopped. We just blazed through it and fall apart when we got home. You're going home, you hit the ground, your mind tells your body what to do. It knows it's off duty and then chooses to get sick. Bands just don't get sick on the road in general. You're not allowed to. After a while, our off-tour lives became at home with the Draculas. We were zombied out on Two and Alls and Smack. Kelly used to send the security guards to wake us up, one to Joe's house, one to mine. Knock on our doors, and if we didn't answer, break them down. If we'd been up all night or up all week, okay, go in. If there's no clean clothes, scoop up all the ones on the floor, throw them into a bag, throw us over their shoulders, and put us into limos and out to the airport. That's how we used to get Joe and me on the road in the bad old days. Kelly'd be out there at the airport, waiting. Oh, shit, where are they now? I don't see them on the horizon. One time when Henry was trying to delay the flight, he told the rest of the crew, look, do whatever you've got to do. Start a fight, tell them there's a bomb on the plane, anything you've got to do, because the band's not here yet, and this is the last flight leaving today, for wherever we were going. All the ticket agent heard was the word bomb, and he alerted the authorities. We all get on the plane, and the door closes. Henry had an ounce of blow on him. It was Allegheny Airlines. They used to have tables on their planes, and we were just about to move up to the front and do the blow on the table. We would snort blow right in front of people back then because no one knew what it was yet. But just then, the plane door opens again, and airport security, FBI, CIA, everybody else with a badge in the world comes on the plane with his ticket agent and hauls Henry off the plane. Henry also happened to have a suitcase with an ounce of pot in it. Kelly claimed it was his, and they never searched it. They took Henry into custody. The day he went to court, we had the band's lawyer, Norman Jacobs, there to represent him. Henry shows up in court early in the morning. The judge looks down at the docket. He's going down the list of cases, and when he comes to Henry's, he goes, "Case is dismissed." Turns out the cop who was in charge of the case got shot the night before. He was murdered by a Harvard football player. For a while, Henry looked like a desperado who'd had this cop knocked off so he wouldn't go to jail. By 1978, we'd gone from being nobodies to being a multi-platinum band with four albums in the space of 3 years. We'd played to as many as 500,000 people at one time, and we had addictions to match. In the early days, we were seen as cash cows. We were worked to death. We did 3 shows a week, and we were kept going on blow. Do you know what a treadmill is? Well, we spent the whole of the 1970s on one. It was tour, album, tour, album, tour, album. No breaks. Everybody knew what we were doing, and we were a mess. No one ever said, you guys had better take a break. I was having seizures and passing out on stage. At any time, I could have had a heart attack, and people would have looked away and said, well, we didn't know what they were doing. Bullshit. There was so much money floating around that no one cared. The promoters at our concerts were awash in cash. They had trunks full of money. We sold tickets like crazy. As a present, our accountants framed all the tickets we sold. We must have grossed at least 140 mil, but the members of the band ended up walking away with no more than 3 mil each. I have no hard feelings, but may they roll over in their graves a billion million years from now. That's all I have to say. I look back and I think, God, man, All we were doing was writing songs, making records, touring. I have a pirate's chest of horror stories of things they've done to my brethren and my band. Unconscionable shit. I look back at that, and in front of Jesus Christ above a heaven's gate, I say, thank you, and fuck you. All our tours had official names, and our names for them. The Aerosmith Express Tour became the WTB Tour for Where's the Blow? But as things got worse, the crew began giving dire names to the tours. The Grab Your Ankles Tour. The Lick the Boots That Kick You Tour. Kelly made up a t-shirt with Why Can't I Fart Anymore on it, meaning we'd all been royally fucked in the ass. By the time we got to late 78, we were all a little burned. And things started to go awry. We were so fried, we could hear our synapses crackling when we went to sleep. The band fell apart when the crew fell apart. The crew fell apart first, and then the band began to unravel. The core rock road dogs began slobbering and howling at the moon. The crew had everything to do with keeping us together. Everyone knew everyone's personalities and how we functioned in our own quirky, dysfunctional way. The sky darkened, and we prayed for rain, but no rain came. It just all worsened. We were a complex mix of utterly unreasonable people, and the momentum revolved around Kelly, who had left after Cal Jam. That's when I began to wonder, why does my house have wheels and my car doesn't? Aerosmith's core group, Kelly, Rabbit, Henry, Night Bob, kept the band rolling during those crazy times. Rabbit left in 78, and Henry left in 1980. The roadies started leaving Aerosmith's interstellar probe like rats leaving a sinking ship. Henry Smith said he had to leave the band to keep being friends. Night Bob left to keep his sanity. It was better to step away and remain friends than to stay and work in that infernal mix. It ended up being the better choice because otherwise I think some of them would have been dead by now. But we never canceled dates. I'd be in the dressing room, freaking out, throwing shit around, and Kelly, designated point guy, would be asking, what the hell is going on now, you fuck? I'd be screaming at him, I want to charter a helicopter right now! Call David! David Krebs would be at home making his 15 or 20% asleep in his penthouse. He didn't have a clue what was going on while we were banging our heads against the wall, losing our minds. Everybody needed time off, but it never occurred to me to cancel. I was Captain Ahab in a mad quest for the Great White Quark. So the gears just kept grinding on. It just got worse and worse. Too much money. If you want to control people and you know they're weak, you give them money. Trust me when I tell you that. Then drugs took everybody down. It was real bad. Nick the roadie died of cirrhosis. Another crew guy hung himself. Our dealers were being garroted, stabbed, and given hot shots. I was the crazed lead singer, too high for my own good. There were car accidents every day. I broke a Porsche in half up in New Hampshire. Drug demons got inside everything and wrecked everything. Drugs even speeded up the band's rhythm. And then one night, between Joe and me, there had always been a certain amount of friction due to the biological fact that we're such different personalities. But whatever stories you've read or Joe and everyone else has told, the $80,000 room service bill, the spilt milk, the solo album, the truth of the matter is that after 9 years of playing, writing, and recording together, I still couldn't get through to Joe. He was in his bubble and I couldn't reach him. He was insulated by heroin, by Alyssa, by his own fucked up lack of self-confidence, his inability to see that the band was bigger than his girlfriend, more important than his problems, his drugs. He has a great front, Joe. He seems so cool, but then don't we all? He needed his woman, Alyssa, who was cool and gorgeous and poisonous. Alyssa was very caught up in that whole fashion thing, a model wannabe kind of girl, coming back from England with beavers and the black nail polish and all that kind of stuff. Joe was into role-playing as well, and they fed off of each other. They were always into each other's games. She was so into herself and was easy to provoke. Once we were flying from New York to L.A., we're all sitting in first class, and there's a guy behind us. He leans over, taps Alyssa on the shoulder, and goes, "Are you what they call a groupie?" She took a glass of wine and threw it on this guy, and that was before the plane even took off. The coup de grace came when I began to confront Joe about the wall he'd built around himself. I'd had enough. "Joe, do you know who you are?" Yeah, he mumbled. There's 100 girls tonight that would have sucked your cock until 1,000,000 o'clock. Are you kidding? I said. Well, Alyssa loves me, he mumbled back. Oh, okay, okay, okay. No one else does? But Alyssa I can trust. Wow. All right, okay. That's it. That's the end of the story. Joe didn't know his own self-worth. He didn't get how strong a personality he was on stage, a character right out of rock mythology. The electric god who wants his guitar to sound like a dinosaur eating cars. How great is that? And together, we were the terrible toxic twins. But he could never see that, so in the end, he left with her. The straw that broke the camel's back came on July 28, 1979, at the World Series of Rock at the Cleveland Stadium. We were the headliners on a bill with Ted Nugent, Journey, Thin Lizzy, and AC/DC. Backstage in the trailer, Alyssa and Terry Hamilton got into a flaming fight. Alyssa took a glass of milk and chucked it all over Terry. I wasn't there. I heard about it after the show. What's going on? I said. Then I got into a fight with Joe. Joe and I weren't there when the Big Bang occurred. We didn't physically see it. We came off stage into this Winnebago parked in the back of this hall. I walked in, panting and dripping, soaking wet, and Alyssa and Terry were screaming at each other. Get the fuck out of here, I yelled. Can't you see we're working in here? That's when I found out that Alyssa had thrown milk at Terry and Terry just wouldn't have it. Alyssa would take no shit from anybody and got off on being that way. And neither would Terry. Tom was spewing. Joe walked in and started sticking up for Alyssa, but when I saw Terry's clothes all soaked, I got into it with Joe. Man, can't you come over here and control your woman? Why does it always have to be like this? Worse than me, and I'm the king of that. Always starting fights and bullshitting, but she did that, and it's what broke up the band that night. Joe was acting like it was Alyssa's right to do what she did, and he sang as much while Terry's still in the room. Didn't care. He liked that his wife was a troublemaker. He got off knowing that Alyssa could morph into a flaming bitch at the drop of a mad hat. I was so drunk, as I was every night after a show, but I remember clearly being on the steps of the trailer, walking down, and yelling at Joe, "You're fucking fired." I don't even know where that chairman of the board voice came from. Never spouted off like I was the leader of this band. We were a gang, a unit, but I was just so angry. That was the only way I knew how to get Alyssa to stop it. You're fucking fired, Joe. You can get into a crazy headspace where all you want to say is, fuck you. I could have just said, I'm out of here, but I didn't. Instead, I said, you're fired. Those were the words. I've never actually punched Joe, but that night, I came really close. It was a mess. So much of this is just so radically true. We completely fried ourselves. But again, unlike Sid Vicious or the Dolls and other bands that were systematically sabotaging their careers and lives, if one was to spell it out clinically, we are going down that road unconsciously. We're just getting fucked up and, incidentally, sabotaging ourselves. Joe and I had that mulish Italian strain of stick-to-itiveness. Joe's not actually Italian, but he's from that island off the coast of Italy. Or is it Portugal? With the exception of his guitar volume, he sure the hell doesn't know how to be loud. And who the fuck knows how happy he was that night? I sure wasn't. And thus ended Aerosmith Mach 1. It was an insane thing to do after all we'd done to make it, but I had gotten so enraged. I'd now destroyed the one thing that had made Aerosmith so powerful. That fine tension that created Aerosmith's feral howl. It didn't matter to Joe that he and I were a team. He didn't care that we'd been together for almost 10 years. All he cared about was getting high and being with her. I was that angry with him. So I went, fuck you, you're fired. I'm going to find a new guitar player. And I did. Jimmy Crespo. At least he wasn't Joe Perry, the cocksucker. Chapter 10, Food Poisoning at a Family Picnic. It's the fall of 1979, just after the fall of Aerosmith Mach 1, the departure of Joe fucking Perry. I'm ready to time travel with my carry-on bag of goodies. Into the great unknown, baby. Yep. We're going to get under the hood. I'm going to tell you the way it was. Unexpurgated. That means nothing censored, nothing gained. Aero mythology was built on the glamour of self-destruction. Self-destruction was great fun. Still, I wouldn't want to do it again. Like the old joke about the Viking, fuck, not another night of rape and pillage, mate. Of course, in rock and roll, we don't classify debauchery as bad behavior. That comes with the territory. Bad, shameful behavior would be turning up for shows in no fit state to play. And there was plenty of that, too. Don't worry, with this band, there was at least another 10 years of wretched excess, drug abuse, and hell-bent self-destruction to come. Every once in a while, I'll hit on something useful to tell you, especially if I'm talking about a subject that I'm kind of an expert on, like roasting marshmallows. How long the stick should be, and how long to leave it in the fire. See, I come from a long line of fact-based, overbearing people. I was living with Sarinda in that gray house up in Sunapee, had my Porsche in the Jeep, Mia was a brand new baby, scoring drugs had become our principal activity. Sarinda, my friend Rick, and I would all drive down to Marshfield outside of Boston to get dope. Joe Perry had thrown me onto this dealer before he split the band. Back then in 79, 80, 2 blocks from Joe's house, lived this guy named John we all got our dope from. A 3-hour drive. I now live in Marshfield. I moved there in 88. When I go home, I get off at the same exit, exit 12, the same one I used to take when I was scoring dope. Ironic or just moronic? Alas, I had kicked Joe out of the band in the middle of Night in the Ruts, our new album due out fall 1979, and Lieber Krebs were putting pressure on me to finish it. Joe played on No Surprise, Chiquita, Cheesecake, 3 Mile Smile, and Bone to Bone, Coney Island Whitefish Boy, the song I wrote about Joe. A Coney Island Whitefish is a rubber. Brad Whitford, Neil Thompson, Jimmy Crespo, and Richie Supa handled guitars on the remaining tracks. Even before we started, I knew what I wanted the title to be, Night in the Ruts. I was into switching the initial letters of names and words like Johnny Ringo into Ronnie Jingo, so Night in the Ruts is code for Right in the Nuts. Back then, you couldn't have had an album title like that. The censors were all over you. You'd get blipped no matter what. You couldn't even sing God Damn It. For the cover, I'd thought of filling a room with nuts. 20 or 30 big burlap bags of nuts would cost you, what, $18 a bag? We'd be standing there up to our waists in nuts, and nobody could argue about the title because we were nuts. It was a takeoff on the cover of The Who Sell Out, where Roger Daltrey is sitting in a bathtub filled with beans and a surprised look on his face. I ran into Roger later on and asked him, "Were you really sitting in a tub full of beans? What was it like in there? Was it really full at the top, or..." "Nah, they like filled it with cloth," he said. "And then the beans on top. I didn't have to sit in all that. Damn." But in the end, we shot the cover in the entrance to a coal mine. It was black with coal dust. I rolled in it for a couple of minutes, and then I went over and rubbed the coal dust on everyone's face. It was a dark and gloomy cover, but we were in a bleak and doomy state. Writing songs had gotten harder and harder, and now I had to write them without Joe. Joe's riffs were the engine, and the engine had stalled. I had tried writing with a bunch of different people. In the spring of 78, I flew up to Sunapee with Bobby Womack, who'd written It's All Over Now, to work on songs. But nothing came of it, just a lot of blow and blowing lines. Sometime in the mid-70s, David Krebs had introduced me to Richie Supa. He was a singer-songwriter signed to Columbia, also managed by Lieber Krebs. I was coming out of a meeting one day, and he was going in, and Krebs said, "You guys should hook up. Richie's a great songwriter, blah, 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 blah." We start talking, and one thing led to another, as it always does. Richie told me he had a studio at his house and all kinds of instruments, so naturally, I had to go over and check it out. I think David gave me a copy of some of his songs, and I thought, yeah, this shit ain't bad. When I was in L.A., I dropped in on Richie's session and sang harmony on a song called Chip Away the Stone, which wound up going on the Cal Jam album. Richie also wrote Lightning Strikes, our first MTV video. Then later on, there was Amazing and Pink. He was my ally when shit would jump off in the band and I was fighting with Joe Perry. I always had Richie to collaborate with. After the band broke up in July 78, he came up to Sunapee that fall and helped me with lyrics. He was also my sounding board and played some guitar tracks on the album. Richie Supa had been in the Rich Kids. He came out with me on my first tour without Joe, along with Joey, Tom, and Brad, just before Jimmy Crespo came in. Richie played guitar and keyboards because he knew the material so well. Given all the drugs on the road, it was incredibly insane. No surprise, the opening track on Night in the Ruts was a mini-autobiography of the band inspired by the night we were signed by Columbia that I rambled on about earlier. A brief encore. 1971, we all heard the starter's gun. New York is such a pity, but at Max's Kansas City, we won. We all shot the shit at the bar with Johnny O'Toole and his scar. And rolling on into Aerosmith's spectacular auto destruction, our headlong highway to hell, cheers, Angus. Midnight lady, situation fetal, vaccinate your ass with your phonograph needle, riding on the wheels of hell, smoking up our axle grease, and concluding with a wish for the acid rain to stop. Rock and roll, junkie whore, got my foot inside the door. Knock, 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 knock. Nobody's keeping score. Bad times go away. Come again some other day. Side two. Remember when albums had two sides? Had some great songs on it. 3 Mile Smile, Reefer-Headed Woman, and Bone to Bone. The last track, Mia, I wrote about my daughter because I missed her. And I was missing in action most of the time. There was a little room on stage behind the amps. Behind the curtains, off limits to the crew, where no one except the band was allowed. That was where drugs were laid out on the table so that we could step behind the curtain during the show and get a snort of cocaine or heroin. Whatever flavor of ice cream we wanted. We'd run out of blow a lot and we'd be writhing. What a great fucking word. W-R-I-T-H-I-N-G. A snake-like word. Sounds like what it is. Like the word sheath. Sheath your weapon. Ooh, it's sexy. Sheath. It's a delicious word. It's like eating a grape and eating a cherry, a nice hard one, just ripe, and making sure you bite down just enough to break through the skin, but not to hurt your teeth on the pit inside. Drugs were just part of being in rock and roll then. Nobody knew the downside of years and years of cocaine abuse, and we could care less. It was the thing to do. Everybody laying it out for you, even the cops. Promoters would have it backstage. There would be a deli platter and a mound of coke. So even if you didn't want to get high that night, even if your nose was falling off because it was raw and bloody from all the snorting, you ran into it at the next gig. Boo-hoo, that was just the climate. I never flew without having some blow on me. By the end of the 70s, some nights I was so out of it, our road manager, Joe Baptista, would have to carry me on stage. The promoter would be sitting there in the dressing room with a look of horror on his face. I'm almost comatose. He's hyperventilating. He thinks he's presenting the legendary cash cow Aerosmith, and now he's going to lose his shirt because the lead singer's down for the count. Is he dead or alive? What am I going to do? You'd better get him on that stage. I don't know how he's going to do this show, but we've got too many kids out there. Not to worry. The minute my feet hit the stage, I'm off and running. I don't know how it happens, but hey, you get up there in front of 20,000 people and it's a high in itself. It's a charged space. Still, the train kept a-rolling and we kept getting high until one night in late 78, I don't know where we were, maybe in Springfield, Illinois, I blacked out in the middle of Reefer-Headed Woman. I got a Reefer-Headed Woman. She fell right down from the sky. Well, I got to drink me 2/5 of whiskey just to get half as high. And then I hit the stage like a fish out of water. I rarely went that far, but the few times I did, it was due to a little matter of not having the right combination of rocket fuel and booze. You drink something, and you go on stage on an empty stomach, and because you're jumping around and sweating and the lights are hot, you get fucked up fast. When you're sitting there, it usually takes 12, 15 minutes for a skin pop in your ass to get in your system. But a runner doing a marathon, because he's inhaling and exhaling so hard, and his blood pressure's rising rapidly, he'll get off probably in 3 minutes flat after you stick a needle in his ass because his metabolism is racing. What happened is this. I was up in Portland, Maine, got drunk. This was around Christmas 1980, and I was waiting for Bibi to come. She was living up there, and it was very emotional seeing her again. She'd gotten pregnant in Germany, and we'd somehow broken up after the tour. I guess I was in denial about it being my child, and she'd had just about enough of me and decided Todd Rundgren would be a better father. Bibi showed me pictures of baby Liv, and we both cried before I went on. And like all nights, I would order two double beefeater martinis. I would down them in five and chew up the olive really quick as I could, swallow it, not throw up. That is kind of where I was at in January 1980. I would drink two of those, and if I had enough blow, I'd be good on stage, but on this particular night, I didn't have any blow. Happened twice in my career that I was so soused and so dizzy that I became a fall-down drunk. Well, rather than fall down drunk in front of the audience and act like a pathetic idiot for an hour while they throw apples at me, I said, fuck this. Please, let's fold the show, man. Get me off stage. But I knew they'd never stop the show just because I was drunk, so I lay down and didn't move, as if I'd fainted. And to make it look convincing, I twitched my foot spastically so they'd look at the twitch and go, look, he's twitching, holy shit, he's having a seizure. I really did it good, and Joe Baptista dragged me off stage. Now, on my children's life, this is the truth of what happened. The band all said he fainted and we took him off stage, the official account. But don't mind me just because it happened to me. I recovered in the dressing room, slept it off at Tom Hamilton's house, and the tour got postponed for a week. After Joe left, he formed the Joe Perry Project. Brad played with us for a while, then he too took off in 82 to form Whitford St. Holmes with Derek St. Holmes, Ted Nugent's ex-vocalist. Fucking great. If you were to ask Brad, he'd probably tell you he had to leave, he couldn't take it. He'd tell you he had to wheel me out and prop me up and hope something would happen. I replaced Joe with Jimmy Crespo because he looked just like Joe and played really good too. Nice long hair, skinny fucking guy. I thought, hey, bingo, what do I need fucking Joe Perry for? But then, think again. Our producer, Jack Douglas, found Rick Dufay to fill in Brad's spot. Rick was a big, tall guy, long hair, great character, but a little out of his mind. I asked him, how did you get in the business? What did you do? And he said, well, once I got out of the loony bin. Turns out the windows had that metal lattice over it, so he took his shirt and kept sticking it in the keyhole of the lock on the window and turning it. And it finally just opened the window and he jumped three stories down, broke both his legs. That kind of stuff. He'd walk into the Lieber Krebs office and say, come on, hit me real hard. He'd lie down on the floor and say, come on, give me a boot right in the face. And I'd say, get out of here, Rick, what the fuck are you doing? He would want you to beat him up. Jack Douglas would smack him. Rick used to wrestle with me and one day he knocked me down. And to this day, my elbow is still puffed up. He knocked me down and I landed on the floor of my apartment and I said, fuck, get the fuck out of here. And that was it. Within a year or so, he was gone. I was stoned for about a year after that, not doing too much, just being a stoned out of it guy, living in New York in my drug-a-log. I got deeper and deeper into drugs and conveniently, Richie Supa had amazing drug connections, always useful. We had the same taste in drugs and women. I got blow from Richie for 10 years, and my heroin. I'd go to Richie's house and he would sell me a tea, a tenth of a gram of heroin, a chunk, a rock, and it was so strong, I could chop it in half and put it in a needle. It would just dissolve and shoot it in my ass and then lick the spoon, and I was good, man, for 4, 5, 6 hours. I'd be strung out and shaking at 4 or 5 in the morning so many times. I'd call him and say, hey, man, I'm really sick. I'd get in a cab. I had no money, so I'd just jump out of the cab and run to the entrance of his building with the cabbie yelling, hey, come back here. I'd knock on his door, and he'd always have something for me. He was so fucking great, Richie. He always had the good stuff. Richie had girls, drugs, and a recording studio, everything I wanted in one place. So I would go to his apartment on First Avenue and 80th Street, hide from the world, and just get crazy. I'd go there, buy $100 worth of cocaine, and then snort $5,000 of it while I was at his house. We'd stay up for days on end. Like many drug addicts, our dopey motto was, better living through chemistry. We were so blatant with drugs in this period, we thought we were invisible. But all the time, there were those beady little eyes watching. Richie got a phone call one night that somebody in the band was about to get busted. You need to clean your apartment, the voice said, and hung up. I don't remember quite how the scenario went down, but we found out that this was coming from somewhere up in Boston. Still, it's not good politics to bust rock and roll stars. It wasn't the thing to do. I mean, Look at Keith Richards up in Montreal with pounds of heroin in a bath salts jar. I've been frisked years back where they actually put their hands on the package and let it go by like, oh, well, no, that's not it. Richie and I were at the Coconut Grove Hotel in Florida one time. I was dope sick, but I knew Richie had some stuff for me. He'd hidden the heroin in his underwear under his balls. I was jonesing. I was sick, and I got to the hotel. I banged on his door. Thank God he's there, I said to myself. Richie, open the fuck up. I'm desperate. He goes, wait a second. I gotta take a leak. He went to take a piss, but he was so stoned that the thing fell in the toilet, and as he flushed, he saw the package go down the drain. And then we had to spend half the night going out to cop. But he knew people, so by 4 o'clock in the morning, I got straight. If there was no free base left, I'd smoke just about anything. Kitty litter, cottage cheese. Richie nicknamed me Spider because I would crawl on the floor looking for a piece of free base that I thought I'd dropped, but probably already smoked. I was always looking for things that weren't there. And then the very drugs that made me ecstatic and godlike started to turn on me. I began looking for things, things that weren't lost and people who weren't there, things invisible to the naked eyeball, but that you know are there. Looking, 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 searching under the bed, examining under the door, looking out the windows, investigating. I was convinced I was under surveillance, believed I was being watched. By whom? By the IBI, of course, the imaginary Bureau of Investigation, my relentless paranoia-induced pursuers. And the IBI was not all that I hallucinated. One time, we were up 2 or 3 days in a row, and Richie found me standing in the doorway with a mop and a pail. Where are you going? He asked me. To wash my car, I said. Give me the mop, give me the pail. Oh, no, I gotta go clean my car. Steve and Gabriel were on the 15th floor of an apartment building in Manhattan. I didn't know where I was, or care. I was stoned out of my mind on drugs almost all the time. I moved out of my house in Sunapee and into Jack Douglas's apartment in New York in the winter of 1982. Then I got an apartment in New York and started to work on the next album, Rock in a Hard Place, with Jimmy Crespo, Rick Dufay, Tom, and Joey. Our cocaine was written into the budget, as 24 track reels of tape. Even if you were out on a yacht or an island somewhere recording on a mobile unit, they'd fly drugs out to you in seaplanes. I wrote the songs on Rock in a Hard Place with Rick Dufay and Jimmy Crespo. Two of these songs, Prelude to Joni and Joni's Butterfly, are about a hallucinatory horse with wings and feathers. I bought some opium from a dealer named Reinhardt, a tongue of opium, black and thick, about 3 inches long, half an inch wide, and half an inch thick. I didn't smoke it. I'd roll it into balls and swallow it. I'd eat it, and it was like, fuck. The best high on the planet is opium. I remember being so high one night, one of those nights when you can't sleep, you're in this wakeless, sleepless place, and a story came over me. I was in a barn, in a stall. There was a lot of hay, and this horse gave birth, with the waters of life pouring out of her. It was a beautiful white horse, and its baby was this kick-ass rocking horse. That's what I called it. It had wings and feathers. I couldn't figure it out. How would a horse have feathers? But that was the fantasy. I wrote two songs around this opium vision. Prelude to Joni told the story. At first, we three thought, 'twas the biblical cord of life. Then noticing 'twas connected to his head, how strange. Not to be believed. I reached out to feel, and the pony's eyes, they opened. The cord got hard. The head looked around. And you know who pushed and gushed the waters of life. First two hoofed feet, then the shine of his fur. But at first my eyes only, feather, feather, wings. The second song was Joni's Butterfly, which I named for a vibrator in the shape of a butterfly. Women strap it on and it stays right here and it goes zzz, zzz, zzz. But for whatever reason, that's what I called the song and took the dream poem into a hallucinated journey. What a stormy night when I met the pony. It was so dark that I could hardly see. It smelled so sweet, you know who and Joni. So many butterflies one could not see. We all could feel desire, took off in flight. It was hotter than fire. Then came the light. I smell the heat, the dancing pony, unwrapped his wings to dry off Joni. The pony, he grew in size, the thunder and rain, and finally realized what it was, what it does, and what it come to say. We put some freaky effects on Rock in a Hard Place. I used a vocoder, essentially a frequency phaser or oscillator that had been used by Pink Floyd and Wendy Carlos. I was talking to one of the recording engineers, and he said, I can create this interesting audio hallucination if you're interested. Oh, yeah? I said, let's do it. He explained that it was a bizarre effect you can create using two stereo speakers in which a third sound appears to be coming from behind you. And I thought, wow, that is so cool. So on Prelude to Joni, I hit an African drum with my elbow and it made this aum sound. You can hear it on the song really loud if you put your speakers in two corners of the room facing you. Suddenly, you'll hear a sound that appears to be coming from somewhere behind your head. People listening to the track would get up from the record in the middle of the song when they heard the drum beat and go to the door behind them to see who'd knocked. We could really fuck with people with this device. I got sold on it and bought it, but little did I know that it doesn't work unless there's music playing as well. That's what throws the knock out of phase. Brimstone, my heroin dealer, also had the best coke and weed. One day, he brought over this girl he was dating, Lisa Barrick. She was gorgeous, but so obviously not interested in me, it kind of pissed me off. So I asked her, are there any more like you at home? Well, yeah, she said. I have an identical twin sister. All right. Her sister, Teresa, worked at a restaurant that served exotic dishes like buffalo burgers. I had a hippopotamus steak the night I went there. We talked. And I told her how odd it was that I would ask Lisa this corny question and how it turned out she really did have an exact copy of herself at home. I was in love. We were making out in hallways and behind closed doors. I was still married to Sarinda when I first met Teresa in 1978, but things between Sarinda and me had already gotten worse and worse. The fights were horrendous. Sarinda could provoke me to violent reactions more than anybody I've ever known. With the possible exception of Joe Perry. Sarinda wasn't gay, but she'd adopted the grandiose gestures of a queen. Ugh. Oh, what are you fucking talking about? Oh, Jesus Christ, you stupid fuck. Jesus, get him the fuck out of here. Oh, what a cunt. Oh, Jesus. That kind of high camp verbosity. Hoo-ah. Sarinda's vicious put-downs were like getting slugged. I couldn't take it after a while because when I'm sober, I get quiet. I think I'm such a fucking bore. Over a period of, say, 25 years, I've gone to a bunch of different rehabs. I don't remember the exact Mongo timelines, so to rehash. All my rehabs. Maybe we can crush one up and share it. 1. Good Samaritan Hospital in New York way back in 83. Then 2. Hazelden, 2, 3, East House, and back to East House, 2, 4, Chit Chat in Wernersville, then 5, Sierra Tucson, then 6, Steps in Malibu in 1996, 7, Las Encinas in 2008 with Aaron, and 8, Betty Ford in 2010, whatever it takes. The first rehab I went to was back in 83 because I was so fucked up I was too wobbly to walk down the sidewalk. One of the reasons I wanted to go to Good Samaritan was that I'd heard they did tests on heroin there. I'll go, I thought. Well, can I be one of the guinea pigs for the heroin? What do we get, a shot every day? I'll do it. Not. That was Good Samaritan. Their motto came from the Bible. The Spirit of the Lord hath sent me to heal the brokenhearted and recover sight to the blind. But as St. Augustine said, please deliver me from my sinful life, O Lord. But not today. While I was on tour with the Jimmy Crespo, Rick Dufay version of Aerosmith in 83, David Krebs had sent a psychiatrist, Dr. Lloyd Moglen, out on tour with the band to see what could be done. But, poor man, he was aboard the ship of fools and their rabid pharmaceuticals. Lost souls. We were dazed and confused, divers in the murky depths of drugs and our din. We were down below the 500-foot line. We couldn't come up for air or we'd get the bends. The doctor threw up his hands. There's no saving them. he cried. The band is broken and cannot be fixed. Sarinda and I were in Florida around this time, and I got into a vicious fist fight with her. She may have looked like Betty Boop, but she could pack a punch like Sonny Liston. Hey, Betty Boop, you got me drooling. I'm buzzing round your hive tonight. You play the hooky instead of schooling. Son of a bitch, put out the light. The fights with Sarinda became so violent that David Krebs sent another psychiatrist to come get me. He brought me out to St. Something's Hospital in San Francisco. It was a mental institution. They put me on a gurney, wheeled me into a room. I was kicking like a mule. My feet were twitching. I'd been up for days. I needed sleep. I drank on the plane, but you can't sleep on booze. You've got to pick it up and drink again after 3 hours. They put an IV in my arm. Ah, doctor, I pleaded. I need some more Valium. The fuck promised me he'd give me Valium. All right, Steven, here it comes. Look. And I'd watch him hook up the tube, but it wasn't Valium. They were dripping saline solution into my arm. Some junkies are so bad that they go shoot water into their veins because they want to shoot something. But I'm not that kind of junkie. I never liked to shoot heroin. I did it once in my vein. Mainly, I shot it in my ass. Sarinda and I were really bad drug addicts. We spent years shooting cocaine. After that, I went with Sarinda down to St. Martin and we got into another raging fight. We had bought all this blow from everybody before we left. The cops knew what was going on and they threw us off the island. We got deported from St. Martin. You can imagine how outrageous you'd have to be to get deported from a Caribbean island for being rowdy. There were insane, uncontrollable fights. She'd hit me in the face, and I'd slap her back. You mean, Steven, you were hitting a woman? Oh, God. Yeah. Sarinda was driving away during this one horrific fight, and I became so enraged, I took my man bag and smashed her windshield. I jumped up on the hood of the car and whacked it, and it shattered into 100 pieces. Cocaine insanity. She got out of the car and came over, and a violent, uncontrollable fight erupted. We were punching and scratching, and we fell over and rolled on the ground. I yelled, "Stop! Stop!" What was this fight about? What they were mostly all about. Drugs. Where's the fucking pills? I don't know. What do you mean you don't know? You had them last. She came over and smacked me in the face with her bag, and the bag fell open, all the pills fell out on the floor. They're in your bag, you fucking cunt. She was fucking hoarding them. Okay, liar, give me the bag. I screamed at her and ripped the bag out of her hand, and in it were bottles and bottles and baggies full of pills. What kind of codependent fucking drug-addicted behavior is that? When I had drugs, I'd always share. Sarinda was more like Joe and Alyssa in that way. They would have pills or coke or heroin, but they wouldn't part with one pill or one line of it even when I begged. I would get dope sick and still have to get out there and sing. You gotta give me a little something, man. I've gotta go on stage tonight. And I would have to go on and perform fucking strung out. Do you have any fucking idea what that's like? I barely got through, barely made it to the end of the show. As bad as things got, and they got insanely ferocious, I never hated Sarinda. I love her to this day. May she be in peace wherever she is. I loved her dearly, and when I went away for drug rehab, I wish she'd have come too. The beginning of the end with Sarinda came about in an odd way. I took Teresa and her sister Lisa to eat dinner at this restaurant called The Twins. It's on the east side, and only twins eat there. It's a really funny scene. I'm in the middle of a tour. The band was cooking, and some guy spots me and goes, "Hey, Steven Tallarico." And next thing I know, it's in the paper. Sarinda hears about it and wants to sue me for divorce, to serve papers. So that blew that night, ruined everything. I guess she loved me, but she didn't know how to do anything for herself. A love story could be written about how she loved me so much that it hurt her that we fought all the time and she became distraught. I'd like that to be the case, but that isn't really our story. We fought in person. We fought on the phone. She'd yell at me. I'd yell at her. Another song inspired, a couple years down the road, from Done with Mirrors, The Reason a Dog. Yak, 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 Lord, you give me the bends. Heads and tails, you're all out of love like the reason a dog has so many friends. He wags his tail instead of his tongue. It was, you know what? Well, fuck you. You better come up here and... I'd say, Sarinda, you gotta calm down. She was just a little too overbearing and over the top for me. Not that I'm exactly a soft-spoken shrinking violet. We clashed, we fought like cats and dogs, and in the end, it just fell apart. I would tell her this on the phone. Honey, I don't think it's gonna work out, so let's get a separation and see, okay? And finally, that's what we did. She didn't like that I was seeing Teresa, naturally. She was jealous, and what more can I say that will make my side the truth and hers not? I was married to Sarinda for 12 years. It's a long time, although we probably only spent 3.5 to 4 years physically together. I was living in New York. Sarinda stayed up in Sunapee. When she came to New York with Mia, I'd have Teresa hide behind the refrigerator and stuff like that. Things were very bad between us. I was trying to get sober. She was still getting high. Our divorce became final in September 1987. A year later, Teresa and I got married. By then, Alyssa was gone too. Her parents put her in the loony bin. Joe's new squeeze was Billy Paulette Montgomery. I introduced her to Teresa. They liked each other. Hey, this could work. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Rockin' a Hard Place only made it to number 32 in the charts in the fall of 82. For the first time in 2 years, we went out on the road again with Jimmy Crespo and Ricky Dufay. But it was a disaster, and I ended up in rehab at Hazelden. 4 fucking hellish nights of withdrawal. I knew what those fucks were up to. I called David Krebs. Get me the fuck out of here. I've seen those movies. Fiendish scientific experiments, spirit possession, hypnotic trances. They're exercising my demons, the precious demons that brought me my power, my drugs, world-renowned narcissism. How do you expect me to write lyrics without demons? They have machines here to siphon off your creative juices and sell them to the Japanese. I so desperately missed that drug high, I would spin until I got dizzy just to feel that narcosis starting to set in, to feel that tingling in my cerebellum. $500 and a fast horse, that's what I always need. Not surprisingly, Hazelden didn't work. I didn't get it. It was years and a few more rehabs before I would get it. All I got was people experience. I'm a performer. I know how to work a room. While I was in Hazelden, Teresa came to visit me and brought me shooters from the plane. I snuck out and drank them all. It was the worst drinking bout I ever had. You could smell the liquor on my breath, and I was ashamed to go to class. I didn't get busted for it, but still, I felt so mortified that I had disgraced myself. My God, by 1983, I had no money and no future, except getting further into the pit. I felt I could hear the voice of doom saying, I'm sorry, man. You've sung your aria. I'd done everything I said I never would. Back in 1976, when I read stories about guys who lost everything and blew $1 million snorting all they had, I used to say, that'll never happen to me. But in the end, I blew $20 million. I snorted my Porsche, I snorted my plane, I snorted my house in that den of drugs and booze and being lost. David Krebs told me I was broke and put me on $20 a day, presumably to curb my drug intake. The way I got around that was to give the limo driver a $200 tip. He'd keep 50, and I'd get the rest to spend on my drug of choice, which increasingly was heroin. I was so out of it that when I got mugged, the guy stuck a pistol in my mouth. I didn't care whether I lived or died. I was half dead anyway. Eventually, I moved into the Gorham Hotel with Teresa. Teresa would go down to Alphabet City, the East Village, daily, and get me dope. Then I met one of our security guys, and he said, what are you, crazy, man? You can get it right on 9th Avenue. I said, bullshit. He goes, 9th Avenue? What are you kidding? 9th Avenue is where you score smack. Everybody knows that. I said, well, I don't know it. Show me. I got in his Corvette. He got me a bag. We drove back to the hotel. I dumped it out on the mirror, and it was a fucking pile. For $20? $20 worth of this stuff was more than you'd get in 5 bindles from downtown. A bindle was just a little bit, and you were lucky to get high off of 2 of them. It was too good to be true. I snorted the stuff from 9th Avenue and went, agh! I spun right there. I got sick. It was fucking great shit. So for about a year, we got bags from there. 5, sometimes 7, mostly 6, from the same guy. It came in a big white envelope. 40 weeks we lived at that hotel. We saved the envelopes, and when you ran out, you could dump them out on the mirror. And when you scraped it all up, you got a nice pile. Enough so that Teresa and I wouldn't get dope sick. The brands of heroin all had these great fucking crazy names. Poison, Fat Boy, Hot Girl, General Westmoreland, Toilet. I remember, in the midst of my din, hearing from fucking Alice Cooper that Joe was going to be his guitar player. I went, what? You've got to be kidding. My soulmate. I was so fucking pissed that I called Joe up and asked him, are you joining Alice Cooper? Are you seriously going to fucking be his guitar player? And he said, yeah, like the prick he is. I said, what the fuck? That's the dumbest fucking thing I ever heard. Just stop. The shit's over. Why don't you just come back with Aerosmith? How could you go be with Alice Cooper? We're Aerosmith. We have something so big that we created ourselves. You're going to join a power that is already there, be a little piece of it? Whereas you are the power in this band. We got to get back together. On my children's lives, that's what happened. I called him. He didn't call me. This is not ego speak. I hadn't spoken to him for more than 2 years, but it felt like way longer. This wasn't in walk this way. It needs to be said. I'd push him. He'd scream at me. We'd almost come to blows. Joe is passive aggressive. He'd say heavy words, but say them quietly. You're always hurt by the ones you love, right? Joe was really pissed off at David Krebs for holding him hostage. Supposedly, Joe owed all this money. An $84,000 room service tab. Why was David charging Joe all that money? I know Joe couldn't afford to pay it. Considering all the money he was making from us, don't you think David at that point could have said, what the hell, fuck it. He's a ruthless guy. Then there was this other little matter with Lieber Krebs, who were both our managers and our accountants. Not that we weren't fucked up, fried, and filleted, but the whole business about Joe and me as the toxic twins, if you really did some digging, you might find that it wasn't all that coincidental that it started hitting the media right around the time Joe was getting ready to sue Krebs over those room service charges. The press loves catchy phrases and cute headlines, and they latch right on to the toxic twins. When I fired Joe, the cum shot was, band breaks up over spilt milk. Ha 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 ha. Now all the journalists in the world get these little stars for being assholes. They're not telling the truth, because they assume nobody wants to hear the truth. Headline, Tyler on drugs. That should do the trick. The picture shows me holding a bottle of pills. Then in the second paragraph it says, those are the aspirins that he bought after he came out of rehab. And you go back and you say, wait a minute. But it said Tyler on drugs. And then it clicks. Ah, that's how they got me to read it. Because if it said, Tyler safe, no one would read it. I'd have to be an icon like Madonna to get a headline with my name and aspirin in the same headline. Madonna now on aspirin. During the years that Joe and I were broken up, I realized that I wasn't half the musician I thought I was without him. But whatever was going to happen with Aerosmith, Joe would not deal with David Krebs again. Since we'd split up, Joe had met a manager named Tim Collins. I met him for the first time with Joe at a French restaurant in New York near 58th Street. We had a hamburger au cheval with an egg on it. Tim said, why don't you just come to Boston? Nah, I don't think so. That's when he said, what if I gave you a gram a day? And he did. That's how he got us up to Boston, me and Teresa. He had his guy Monkey bring us over a gram at the hotel every morning at the Howard Johnson's in Cambridge. He wanted to keep me there while he tried to put the band back together. Tim played the game all managers play. He'd tell me Joe was interested in getting the band back together, that he'd really missed playing with Aerosmith, blah, blah, blah. And then he'd go back to Joe and tell him I wanted more than anything to reunite the band, that Joe was the essential element, and without him, da-dee-da-da, which was true, but it was all done through innuendo and manipulation. And that's how Joe and I started to work together. Again. Managers are predatory. They troll the stars. And we got trolled, used, and abused more than once. Not long after he'd got us, he was down at a club in New York at a party, drunk out of his mind, bragging that he's got Aerosmith. And this guy he was talking to said, Aerosmith? Good luck. I used to book them. You'll never manage those guys. They're too stoned. And by the way, the only thing that'll get them out of that is AA. And Tim went, huh? What the? But that stuck in his mind, and it would resurface a few years later when the band was totally fucked up again, and he needed a way to pull us out of freefall. I went to see the Joe Perry Project perform at the Bottom Line. Then Joe came to the Worcester Centrum in the spring of 1983 to see an Aerosmith concert. We did a few lines of heroin in the dressing room, just for old time's sake. Joe, check this shit out. You're not gonna fucking believe it. See what you've been missing? And then I fell down. I just got too high. That's only happened 3 times in 30 years. So drunk or so stoned that everything was spinning so much I couldn't stop it. This was at the height of my addictions and whatever the fuck. When you're in that state, even when you lie down on your bed, the room is still spinning around you. Anyway, we do a bunch of lines, and I get on stage at the Centrum, and I realize I'm lost. I can't function at all. It's like, oh, God, please help me. Those few times when I got so fucking drunk or high that I couldn't stand up, we had to cancel that show. I think it was the 3rd song, it takes about 15 minutes or whatever is in you to really take hold, when I realized I was in serious trouble. Oh, dear God, my God. I stumbled over to the drum riser. I put my hand out, slipped, and missed it. It was totally fucked up, a great way to reintroduce Joe to the band. But as Joe always says, it's good to see a train wreck on stage. It means there's something going on up there. Fallible fuck-ups, not the click track machine flawlessly reproducing its iPod hits. But in my case, it was getting a little too close to a demolition derby. In early 1984, the band got back together at Tom's house. That was great. The old machine was rolling and tumbling again, and stumbling and mumbling and falling down and disintegrating. For the first 3 years we were back together, everybody was so fucked up. Eventually, it reached critical mass, and at that point, Tim Collins recalled what the promoter had said to him when he first got the band. It's never gonna work. These guys are alcoholics and drug addicts. Your only hope is AA. It was time to get Aerosmith clean and sober. Not everybody in the band, of course. Since I was the designated fuck-up, I was the first one to get sent away. I wound up at East House, a rehab facility at McLean Hospital in Belmont, Massachusetts, in February of 1985. I put it in a song called My Fist Your Face. Naturally, I wasn't exactly ready to give everything up on the spot either. While I was in there, Teresa went to get me some blow from the only dealer she knew, a place in Queens. Now, as it happened, a friend of Tim Collins's was there at the same time getting blow for Tim. Joe heard about it, called Teresa up, and said, I'll break your fucking legs if you give Steven any cocaine. Meanwhile, Joe had gotten the okay from the Vatican master Tim Collins to carry on, drink, do whatever he wanted. They figured as long as they got me sober, the band would be fine. I had to be straight in order for Aerosmith to work. Gotta get Steven straight. So it was back into East House at McLean a second time in the fall that same year. At McLean, I met a therapist named Bob Hearn, and for the first time, I began to think about another path to enlightenment other than drugs and booze. The problem is that rock and roll is a fantasy life, and part of that fantasy is being high. Like most rock stars, I suffer from terminal adolescence. I'll never grow up. The animated 12-year-old thing. Without that, you wouldn't get up on stage in the first place. In rock, you never have to grow up because you're so insulated. You never have to deal with anything. Everything's done for you. You're surrounded by staff and crew and managers and promoters and PR yentas. How do you rent a car? Buy a plane ticket? Reserve a hotel room? Oh, you've got to call them first. In rehab, they have all these theories. No, 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 Steven, don't paint with your right hand. Paint with your non-dominant hand. Why? Because I don't know how to play with my left hand? Yes, that way you may come up with something that you don't know was in there. Right. And even if I, through prayer, abstinence, and superhuman strength of character, were able to forswear the demons of dope and alcohol, what about my mates? Of course I'd call Tim from rehab from time to time and say, where's Joe? When is Joe coming here? Oh, Joe's down in the islands. Tim let Joe go to an island where he was drinking Paregoric, that baby for the gums, and he'd dip a cigarette in it, smoke it, or drink the bottle, and you can get so stoned on a bottle of Paregoric. Trouble with me, the designated patient, was that everyone else in the band and all the people around